unless you're prepared to meet him properly. That's all. The mule was alone again. He let the lights die, and the wall before him kicked to transparency again. The sky was purple now, and the city was a smudge of light on the horizon. What was it all for? And if he were the master of all there was, what then? Would it really stop men like Pritchard from being straight and tall, self-confident, strong? Would Bale Channis lose his looks? Would he himself be other than he was? He cursed his doubts. What was he really after? The cool overhead warning light flickered. He could follow the progress of the man who had entered the palace, and almost against his will, he felt the soft wash of emotional content touch the fibers of his brain. He recognized the identity without an effort. It was Channis. Here the mule saw no uniformity, but the primitive diversity of a strong mind, untouched and unmolded, except by the manifold disorganizations of the universe. It writhed in floods and waves. There was caution on the surface, a thin, smoothing effect, but with touches of cynical ribaldry in the hidden eddies of it. And underneath there was the strong flow of self-interest and self-love, with a gush of cruel humor here and there, and a deep, still pool of ambition underlying all. The mule felt that he could reach out and dam the current, wrench the pool from its basin, and turn it in another course, dry up one flow and begin another. But what of it? If he could bend Channis's curly head in the profoundest adoration, would that change his own grotesquerie that made him shun the day and love the night, and made him a recluse inside an empire that was unconditionally his? The door behind him opened, and he turned. The transparency of the wall faded to opacity, and the darkness gave way to the whitely blazing artifice of atomic power. Bale Channis sat down lightly and said, "This is a not quite unexpected honor, sir." The mule rubbed his proboscis with all four fingers at once, and sounded a bit irritable in his response. "Why so, young man?" "A hunch, I suppose. Unless I want to admit that I've been listening to rumors." "Rumors? Which one of the several dozen varieties are you referring to?" "Those that say a renewal of the galactic offensive is being planned. It is a hope with me that such is true, and that I might play an appropriate part." "Then you think there is a second foundation?" "Why not? It would make things so much more interesting." "And you find interest in it as well?" "Certainly, in the very mystery of it. What better subject could you find for conjecture?" "The newspaper supplements are full of nothing else lately, which is probably significant. The Cosmos had one of its feature writers compose a weirdy about a world consisting of beings of pure mind, the second foundation, you see, who had developed mental force to energies large enough to compete with any known to physical science. Spaceships could be blasted light years away. Planets could be turned out of their orbits." "Interesting. Yes, but do you have any notions on the subject? Do you subscribe to this mind-power notion?" "Galaxy, no. You think creatures like that would stay on their own planet?" "No, sir, I think the second foundation remains hidden because it is weaker than we think." "In that case, I can explain myself very easily. How would you like to head an expedition to locate the second foundation?" For a moment, Channis seemed caught up by the sudden rush of events at just a little greater speed than he was prepared for. His tongue had apparently skidded to a halt in a lengthening silence. The mule said dryly, "Well?" Channis corrugated his forehead. "Certainly, but where am I to go? Have you any information available?" "General Pritchard will be with you." "Then I'm not to head it." "Judge for yourself when I'm done. Listen, you're not of the Foundation. You're a native of Calgan, aren't you?" "Yes." "Well, then your knowledge of the Selden plan may be vague." This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. "Listen, you're not of the Foundation. You're a native of Calgan, aren't you?" "Yes." "Well, then your knowledge of the Selden plan may be vague. When the First Galactic Empire was falling, Harry Selden and a group of psychohistorians, analyzing the future course of history by mathematical tools no longer available in these degenerate times, set up two foundations, one at each end of the galaxy, in such a way that the economic and sociological forces that were slowly evolving would make them serve as foci for the Second Empire. Harry Seldon planned on 1,000 years to accomplish that, and it would have taken 30,000 without the foundations. But he didn't count on me. I am a mutant, and I am unpredictable by psychohistory, which can only deal with the average reactions of numbers. Do you understand? Perfectly, sir. But how does that involve me? You'll understand shortly. I intend to unite the galaxy now, and reach Seldon's 1,000-year goal in 300. One foundation, the world of physical scientists, is still flourishing under me, under the prosperity and order of the Union. The atomic weapons they have developed are capable of dealing with anything in the galaxy, except perhaps the Second Foundation. So I must know more about it. General Pritchard is of the definite opinion that it does not exist at all. I know otherwise. Janice said delicately, "How do you know, sir?" And the mule's words were suddenly liquid indignation. "Because minds under my control have been interfered with, delicately, subtly, but not so subtly that I couldn't notice. And these interferences are increasing, and hitting valuable men at important times. Do you wonder now that a certain discretion has kept me motionless these years? That is your importance. General Pritchard is the best man left me, so he is no longer safe. Of course, he does not know that. But you are unconverted, and therefore not instantly detectable as a mule's man. You may fool the Second Foundation longer than one of my own men would, perhaps just sufficiently longer. Do you understand?" Yes, but pardon me, sir, if I question you. How are these men of yours disturbed, so that I might detect change in General Pritchard in case any occurs? Are they unconverted again? Do they become disloyal? No. I told you it was subtle. It's more disturbing than that, because it's harder to detect, and sometimes I have to wait before acting, uncertain whether a key man is being normally erratic or has been tampered with. Their loyalty is left intact, but initiative and ingenuity are rubbed out. I'm left with a perfectly normal person, apparently, but one completely useless. In the last year, 6 have been so treated. 6 of my best. A corner of his mouth lifted. They're in charge of training bases now, and my most earnest wishes go with them that no emergencies come up for them to decide upon. Suppose, sir, suppose it were not the Second Foundation. What if it were another, such as yourself, another mutant? The planning is too careful, too long range. A single man would be in a greater hurry. No, it is a world, and you are to be my weapon against it. Janice's eyes shone as he said, "I'm delighted at the chance." But the mule caught the sudden emotional upwelling. He said, "Yes, apparently it occurs to you that you will perform a unique service, worthy of a unique reward, perhaps even that of being my successor. Quite so. But there are unique punishments, too, you know. My emotional gymnastics are not confined to the creation of loyalty alone." And the little smile on his thin lips was grim, as Janice leaped out of his seat in horror. For just an instant, just one flashing instant, Janice had felt the pang of an overwhelming grief close over him. It had slammed down with a physical pain that had blackened his mind unbearably, and then lifted. Now nothing was left but the strong wash of anger. The mule said, "Anger won't help. Yes, you're covering it up now, aren't you? But I can see it. So just remember, that sort of business can be made more intense and kept up. I've killed men by emotional control, and there's no death crueler." He paused. "That's all." The mule was alone again. He let the lights die, and the wall before him kicked to transparency again. The sky was black, and the rising body of the galactic lens was spreading its bespanglement across the velvet depths of space. All that haze of nebula was a mass of stars so numerous that they melted one into the other, and left nothing but a cloud of light, and all to be his. And now, but one last arrangement to make, and he could sleep. First Interlude. The Executive Council of the Second Foundation was in session. To us, they are merely voices. Neither the exact scene of the meeting, nor the identity of those present, are essential at the point. Nor, strictly speaking, can we even consider an exact reproduction of any part of the session, unless we wish to sacrifice completely even the minimum comprehensibility we have a right to expect. We deal here with psychologists, and not merely psychologists. Let us say, rather, scientists with a psychological orientation, that is, men whose fundamental conception of scientific philosophy is pointed in an entirely different direction from all of the orientations we know. The psychology of scientists brought up among the axioms deduced from the observational habits of physical science has only the vaguest relationship to psychology, which is about as far as I can go in explaining color to a blind man, with myself as blind as the audience. The point being made is that the minds assembled understood thoroughly the workings of each other, not only by general theory, but by the specific application over a long period of these theories to particular individuals. Speech, as known to us, was unnecessary. A fragment of a sentence amounted almost to long-winded redundancy. A gesture, a grunt, the curve of a facial line, even a significantly timed pause, yielded informational juice. The liberty is taken, therefore, of freely translating a small portion of the conference into the extremely specific word combinations necessary to minds oriented from childhood to a physical science philosophy, even at the risk of losing the more delicate nuances. There was one voice predominant, and that belonged to the individual known simply as the first speaker. He said, "It is apparently quite definite now as to what stopped the mule in his first mad rush. I can't say that the matter reflects credit upon the organization of the situation. Apparently he almost located us by means of the artificially heightened brain energy of what they call a psychologist on the first foundation. This psychologist was killed just before he could communicate his discovery to the mule. The events leading to that killing were completely fortuitous for all calculations below phase three. Suppose you take over." It was the fifth speaker who was indicated by an inflection of the voice. He said, in grim nuances, "It is certain that the situation was mishandled. We are, of course, highly vulnerable under mass attack, particularly an attack led by such a mental phenomenon as the mule. Shortly after he first achieved galactic eminence with the conquest of the First Foundation, half a year after, to be exact, he was on Trantor. Within another half year, he would have been here, and the odds would have been stupendously against us, 96.3 plus or minus 0.05%, to be exact. We have spent considerable time analyzing the forces that stopped him. We know, of course, what was driving him on so in the first place. The internal ramifications of his physical deformity and mental uniqueness are obvious to all of us. However, it was only through penetration to phase three that we could determine, after the fact, the possibility of his anomalous action in the presence of another human being who had an honest affection for him. And since such an anomalous action would depend upon the presence of such another human being at the appropriate time, to that extent the whole affair was fortuitous. Our agents are certain that it was a girl that killed the mule psychologist, a girl for whom the mule felt trust out of sentiment, and whom he, therefore, did not control mentally, simply because she liked him. Since that event, and for those who want the details, a mathematical treatment of the subject has been drawn up for the Central Library, which warned us, we have held the mule off by unorthodox methods, with which we daily risk Selden's entire scheme of history. That is all." The first speaker paused an instant to allow the individuals assembled to absorb the full implications. He said, "The situation is then highly unstable. With Selden's original scheme bent to the fracture point, and I must emphasize that we have blundered badly in this whole matter, in our horrible lack of foresight, we are faced with an irreversible breakdown of the plan. Time is passing us by. I think there is only one solution left us, and even that is risky. We must allow the mule to find us, in a sense." Another pause, in which he gathered the reactions. Then, "I repeat, in a sense." Chapter 2. Two Men Without the Mule. The ship was in near readiness. Nothing lacked but the destination. The mule had suggested a return to Trantor, the world that was the hulk of an incomparable galactic metropolis of the hugest empire mankind had ever known, the dead world that had been capital of all the stars. Pritchard disapproved. It was an old path, sucked dry. He found Bail Channis in the ship's navigation room. The young man's curly hair was just sufficiently disheveled to allow a single curl to droop over the forehead, as if it had been carefully placed there, and even teeth showed in a smile that matched it. Vaguely, the stiff officer felt himself harden against the other. Channis's excitement was evident. "Pritchard, it's too far a coincidence," the general said coldly. "I'm not aware of the subject of conversation." "Oh, well then drag up a chair, old man, and let's get into it. I've been going over your notes. I find them excellent." "How pleasant that you do. But I'm wondering if you've come to the conclusions I have. Have you ever tried analyzing the problem deductively? I mean, it's all very well to comb the stars at random, and to have done all you did in 5 expeditions is quite a bit of star hopping, that's obvious. But have you calculated how long it would take to go through every known world at this rate?" "Yes, several times." Pritchard felt no need to meet the young man halfway, but there was the importance of filching the other's mind, the other's uncontrolled and hence unpredictable mind. "Well then, suppose we're analytical about it and try to decide just what we're looking for." "The second foundation," said Pritchard grimly. "A foundation of psychologists," corrected Channis, "who are as weak in physical science as the first foundation was weak in psychology." "Well, you're from the first foundation, which I'm not. The implications are probably obvious to you. We must find a world which rules by virtue of mental skills, and yet which is very backward scientifically." "Is that necessarily so?" questioned Pritchard quietly. "Our own union of worlds isn't backward scientifically, even though our ruler owes his strength to his mental powers." "Because he has the skills of the first foundation to draw upon," came the slightly impatient answer. "And that is the only such reservoir of knowledge in the galaxy. The second foundation must live among the dry crumbs of the broken galactic empire. There are no pickings there." "So then you postulate mental power sufficient to establish their rule over a group of worlds, and physical helplessness as well?" "Comparative physical helplessness. Against the decadent neighboring areas, they are competent to defend themselves. Against the resurgent forces of the Mule, with his background of a mature atomic economy, they cannot stand. Else, why is their location so well hidden, both at the start by the founder Harry Seldon, and now by themselves? Your own first foundation made no secret of its existence, and did not have it made for them, when they were an undefended single city on a lonely planet 300 years ago." The smooth lines of Pritchard's dark face twitched sardonically. "And now that you've finished your deep analysis, would you like a list of all the kingdoms, republics, planet-states, and dictatorships of one sort or another in that political wilderness out there that correspond to your description and to several factors besides? All this has been considered, then." Channis lost none of his brashness. "You won't find it here, naturally. But we have a completely worked-out guide to the political units of the opposing periphery. Really, did you suppose the Mule would work entirely hit and miss? Well, then," and the young man's voice rose in a burst of energy, "what about the oligarchy of Tazenda?" Pritchard touched his ear thoughtfully. "Tazenda. Oh, I think I know it. They're not in the periphery, are they? Seems to me they're fully a third of the way towards the center of the galaxy." "Yes, what of that?" "The records we have place the second foundation at the other end of the galaxy. Space knows it's the only thing we have to go on. Why talk of Tazenda anyway? Its angular deviation from the first foundation radian is only about 110 to 120 degrees anyway. Nowhere near 180. There's another point in the records. The second foundation was established at Star's End. No such region in the galaxy has ever been located, because it was a local name, suppressed later for greater secrecy, or maybe one invented for the purpose by Seldon and his group. Yet there's some relationship between Star's End and Tazenda, don't you think? A vague similarity in sound? Insufficient. Have you ever been there? No. Yet it is mentioned in your records. Where? Oh, yes. But that was merely to take on food and water. There was certainly nothing remarkable about the world. Did you land at the ruling planet, the center of government? I couldn't possibly say. Janice brooded about it under the other's cold gaze. Then, would you look at the lens with me for a moment? Certainly. The lens was perhaps the newest feature of the interstellar cruisers of the day. Actually, It was a complicated calculating machine, which could throw on a screen a reproduction of the night sky, as seen from any given point of the galaxy. Chanis adjusted the coordinate points, and the wall lights of the pilot room were extinguished. In the dim red light at the control board of the lens, Chanis's face glowed ruddily. Pritchard sat in the pilot seat, long legs crossed, face lost in the gloom. Slowly, as the induction period passed, the points of light brightened on the screen. And then they were thick and bright with the generously populated star groupings of the galaxy's center. This, explained Chanis, is the winter night sky as seen from Trantor. That is the important point that, as far as I know, has been neglected so far in your search. All intelligent orientation must start from Trantor as zero point. Trantor was the capital of the Galactic Empire, even more so scientifically and culturally than politically. And therefore, the significance of any descriptive name should stem, 9 times out of 10, from a Trantorian orientation. You'll remember in this connection that, although Selden was from Helicon, towards the periphery, his group worked on Trantor itself. What is it you're trying to show me? Pritchard's level voice plunged icily into the gathering enthusiasm of the other. The map will explain it. Do you see the dark nebula? The shadow of his arm fell upon the screen, which took on the bespanglement of the galaxy. The pointing finger ended on a tiny patch of black that seemed a hole in the speckled fabric of light. The stellographical records call it Pellet's Nebula. Watch it. I'm going to expand the image. Pritchard had watched the phenomenon of lens image expansion before, but he still caught his breath. It was like being at the visiplate of a spaceship storming through a horribly crowded galaxy without entering hyperspace. The stars diverged towards them from a common center, flared outwards, and tumbled off the edge of the screen. Single points became double, then globular. Hazy patches dissolved into myriad points, and always that illusion of motion. Chanis spoke through it all. You'll notice that we are moving along the direct line from Trantor to Pellet's Nebula, so that in effect we are still looking at a stellar orientation equivalent to that of Trantor. There is probably a slight error because of the gravitic deviation of light that I haven't the math to calculate for, but I'm sure it can't be significant. The darkness was spreading over the screen. As the rate of magnification slowed, the stars slipped off the four ends of the screen in a regretful leave-taking. At the rims of the growing nebula, the brilliant universe of stars shone abruptly, in token for that light which was merely hidden behind the swirling, unradiating atom fragments of sodium and calcium that filled cubic parsecs of space. And Chanis pointed again. This has been called the mouth by the inhabitants of that region of space, and that is significant, because it is only from the Trantorian orientation that it looks like a mouth. What he indicated was a rift in the body of the nebula, shaped like a ragged, grinning mouth in profile, outlined by the glazing glory of the starlight with which it was filled. Follow the mouth, said Chanis. Follow the mouth towards the gullet as it narrows down to a thin, splintering line of light. Again the screen expanded a trifle, until the nebula stretched away from the mouth to block off all the screen but that narrow trickle, and Chanis's fingers silently followed it down to where it straggled to a halt. And then, as his finger continued moving onward, to a spot where one single star sparked lonesomely. And there his finger halted, for beyond that was blackness, unrelieved. Star's end, said the young man simply. The fabric of the nebula is thin there, and the light of that one star finds its way through in just that one direction, to shine on Trantor. You're trying to tell me that... The voice of the mule's general died in suspicion. I'm not trying. That is Tazenda. Star's end. The lights went on. The lens flicked off. Pritchard reached Chanis in 3 long strides. What made you think of this? And Chanis leaned back in his chair with a queerly puzzled expression on his face. It was accidental. I'd like to take intellectual credit for this, but it was only accidental. In any case, however it happens, it fits. According to our references, Tazenda is an oligarchy. It rules 27 inhabited planets. It is not advanced scientifically. And most of all, it is an obscure world that has adhered to a strict neutrality in the local politics of that stellar region, and is not expansionist. I think we ought to see it. Have you informed the mule of this? No, Nor shall we. We're in space now, about to make the first hop. Pritchard, in sudden horror, sprang to the visiplate. Cold space met his eyes when he adjusted it. He gazed fixedly at the view, then turned. Automatically, his hand reached for the hard, comfortable curve of the butt of his blaster. By whose order? By my order, General. It was the first time Channis had ever used the other's title. While I was engaging you here, you probably felt no acceleration because it came at the moment I was expanding the field of the lens, and you undoubtedly imagined it to be an illusion of the apparent star motion. Why? Just what are you doing? What was the point of your nonsense about Tezenda, then? That was no nonsense. I was completely serious. We're going there. We left today because we were scheduled to leave 3 days from now. General, you don't believe there is a second foundation, and I do. You are merely following the mule's orders without faith. I recognize a serious danger. The second foundation has now had 5 years to prepare. How they prepared, I don't know. But what if they have agents on Calgan? If I carry about in my mind the knowledge of the whereabouts of the second foundation, they may discover that. My life might no longer be safe, and I have a great affection for my life. Even on a thin and remote possibility such as that, I would rather play safe. No one knows of Tezenda but you, and you found out only after we were out in space. And even so, there is the question of the crew. Channis was smiling again, ironically, in obviously complete control of the situation. Pritchard's hand fell away from his blaster, and for a moment a vague discomfort pierced him. What kept him from action? What deadened him? There was a time when he was a rebellious and unpromoted captain of the First Foundation's commercial empire, when it would have been himself rather than Channis who would have taken prompt and daring action such as that. Was the mule right? Was his controlled mind so concerned with obedience as to lose initiative? He felt a thickening despondency drive him down into a strange lassitude. He said, "Well done. However, you will consult me in the future before making decisions of this nature." The flickering signal caught his attention. "That's the engine room," said Channis casually. "They warmed up on 5 minutes' notice, and I asked them to let me know if there was any trouble. Want to hold the fort?" Pritchard nodded mutely, and cogitated in the sudden loneliness on the evils of approaching 50. The visiplate was sparsely starred. The main body of the galaxy misted one end. What if he were free of the mule's influence? But he recoiled in horror at the thought. Chief Engineer Huxlani looked sharply at the young, ununiformed man, who carried himself with the assurance of a fleet officer and seemed to be in a position of authority. Huxlani, as a regular fleet man from the days his chin had ripped milk, generally confused authority with specific insignia. But the mule had appointed this man, and the mule was, of course, the last word. The only word, for that matter. Not even subconsciously did he question that. Emotional control went deep. He handed Channis the little oval object without a word. Channis hefted it and smiled engagingly. "You're a Foundation man, aren't you, Chief?"
"Yes, sir. I served in the Foundation fleet 18 years before the First Citizen took over."
"Foundation training in engineering?"
"Qualified technician, first class. Central school on Anacreon."
"Good enough. And you found this on the communication circuit, where I asked you to look?"
"Yes, sir."
"Does it belong there?"
"No, sir."
"Then what is it?"
"A hypertracer, sir."
"No, that's not enough. I'm not a Foundation man. What is it?"
"It's a device to allow the ship to be traced through hyperspace.
In other words, we can be followed anywhere."
"Yes, sir."
"All right. It's a recent invention, isn't it? It was developed by one of the research institutes set up by the First Citizen, wasn't it?"
"I believe so, sir."
"And its workings are a government secret, right?"
"I believe so, sir."
"Yet here it is." "Intriguing." Channis tossed the hypertracer methodically from hand to hand for a few seconds. Then sharply, he held it out. "Take it, then, and put it back exactly where you found it, and exactly how you found it. Understand? And then forget this incident. Entirely." The chief choked down his near-automatic salute, turned sharply, and left. The ship bounded through the galaxy, its path a wide-spaced dotted line through the stars. The dots referred to were the scant stretches of 10 to 60 light seconds spent in normal space, and between them stretched the 100 and up light-year gaps that represented the hops through hyperspace. Bail Channis sat at the control panel of the lens, and felt again the involuntary surge of near worship at the contemplation of it. He was not a Foundation man, and the interplay of forces at the twist of a knob or the breaking of a contact was not second nature to him. Not that the lens ought quite to bore even a Foundation man. Within its unbelievably compact body were enough electronic circuits to pinpoint accurately 100 million separate stars in exact relationship to each other. And as if that were not a feat in itself, it was further capable of translating any given portion of the galactic field along any of the 3 spatial axes, or to rotate any portion of the field about a center. It was because of that that the lens had performed a near revolution in interstellar travel. In the younger days of interstellar travel, the calculation of each hop through hyperspace meant any amount of work from a day to a week, and the larger portion of such work was the more or less precise calculation of ship's position on the galactic scale of reference. Essentially, that meant the accurate observation of at least 3 widely spaced stars, the position of which, with reference to the arbitrary galactic 000, were known. And it is the word known that is the catch. To any who know the star field well from one certain reference point, stars are as individual as people. Jump 10 parsecs, however, and not even your own sun is recognizable. It may not even be visible. The answer was, of course, spectroscopic analysis. For centuries, the main object of interstellar engineering was the analysis of the light signature of more and more stars in greater and greater detail. With this, and the growing precision of the hop itself, standard routes of travel through the galaxy were adopted, and interstellar travel became less of an art and more of a science. And yet, even under the Foundation, with improved calculating machines and a new method of mechanically scanning the star field for a known light signature, it sometimes took days to locate 3 stars and then calculate position in regions not previously familiar to the pilot. It was the lens that changed all that. For one thing, it required only a single known star. For another, even a space tyro such as Chanis could operate it. The nearest sizable star at the moment was Vincetori, according to Hopp calculations, and on the visiplate now, a bright star was centered. Chanis hoped that it was Vincetori. The field screen of the lens was thrown directly next that of the visiplate, and with careful fingers, Chanis punched out the coordinates of Vincetori. He closed a relay, and the star field sprang to bright view. In it, too, a bright star was centered, but otherwise there seemed no relationship. He adjusted the lens along the Z-axis and expanded the field to where the photometer showed both centered stars to be of equal brightness. Chanis looked for a second star, sizably bright, on the visiplate, and found one on the field screen to correspond. Slowly he rotated the screen to similar angular deflection. He twisted his mouth and rejected the result with a grimace. Again he rotated, and another bright star was brought into position, and a third. And then he grinned. That did it. Perhaps a specialist with trained relationship perception might have clicked first try, but he'd settled for 3. That was the adjustment. In the final step, the 2 fields overlapped and merged into a sea of not quite rightness. Most of the stars were close doubles, but the fine adjustment did not take long. The double stars melted together, 1 field remained, and the ship's position could now be read directly off the dials. The entire procedure had taken less than 30 minutes. Chanis found Han Pritchard in his private quarters. The general was quite apparently preparing for bed. He looked up. This book is continued on cassette number 2. Chanis found Han Pritchard in his private quarters. The general was quite apparently preparing for bed. He looked up. News? Not particularly. We'll be at Tazenda in another hop. I know. I don't want to bother you if you're turning in, but have you looked through the film we picked up in Sill? Han Pritchard cast a disparaging look at the article in question, where it lay in its black case upon his low bookshelf. Yes. And what do you think? I think that if there was ever any science to history, it has been quite lost in this region of the galaxy. Chanis grinned broadly. I know what you mean. Rather barren, isn't it? Not if you enjoy personal chronicles of rulers. Probably unreliable, I should say, in both directions. Where history concerns mainly personalities, the drawings become either black or white, according to the interests of the writer. I find it all remarkably useless. But there is talk about Tazenda.
That's the point I tried to make when I gave you the film. It's the only one I could find that even mentioned them. All right. They have good rulers and bad. They've conquered a few planets, won some battles, lost a few. There is nothing distinctive about them. I don't think much of your theory, Janice. But you've missed a few points. Didn't you notice that they never formed coalitions? They always remained completely outside the politics of this corner of the star swarm. As you say, they conquered a few planets, but then they stopped. And that without any startling defeat of consequence. It's just as if they spread out enough to protect themselves, but not enough to attract attention. Very well, came the unemotional response. I have no objection to landing. At the worst, a little lost time. Oh, no. At the worst, complete defeat. If it is the second foundation. Remember, it would be a world of space knows how many mules. What do you plan to do? Land on some minor subject planet, find out as much as we can about Tazenda first, then improvise from that. All right, no objection. If you don't mind now, I would like the lights out. Janice left with a wave of his hand. And in the darkness of a tiny room in an island of driving metal, lost in the vastness of space, General Han Pritcher remained awake, following the thoughts that led him through such fantastic reaches. If everything he had so painfully decided were true, and how all the facts were beginning to fit, then Tazenda was the second foundation. There was no way out. But how? How? Could it be Tazenda? An ordinary world? One without distinction? A slum lost amid the wreckage of an empire? A splinter among the fragments? He remembered, as from a distance, the mule's shriveled face and his thin voice as he used to speak of the old Foundation psychologist, Ebling Miz, the one man who had maybe learned the secret of the second Foundation. Pritcher recalled the tension of the mule's words. It was as if astonishment had overwhelmed Miz. It was as though something about the second Foundation had surpassed all his expectations, had driven in a direction completely different from what he might have assumed. If I could only have read his thoughts rather than his emotions. Yet the emotions were plain, and above everything else was this vast surprise. Surprise was the keynote, something supremely astonishing. And now came this boy, this grinning youngster, glibly joyful about Tazenda and its undistinguished subnormality. And he had to be right. He had to. Otherwise nothing made sense. Pritchard's last conscious thought had a touch of grimness. That hypertracer along the etheric tube was still there. He had checked it 1 hour back, with Janice well out of the way. Second interlude. It was a casual meeting in the anteroom of the council chamber, just a few minutes before passing into the chamber to take up the business of the day, and the few thoughts flashed back and forth quickly. So the mule is on his way. That's what I hear, too. Risky. Mighty risky. Not if affairs adhere to the functions set up. The mule is not an ordinary man, and it is difficult to manipulate his chosen instruments without detection by him. The controlled minds are difficult to touch. They say he's caught on to a few cases. Yes, I don't see how that can be avoided. Uncontrolled minds are easier, but so few are in positions of authority under him. They entered the chamber. Others of the Second Foundation followed them. Chapter 3. Two Men and a Peasant. Rossim is one of those marginal worlds, usually neglected in galactic history, and scarcely ever obtruding itself upon the notice of men of the myriad happier planets. In the latter days of the Galactic Empire, a few political prisoners had inhabited its wastes, while an observatory and a small naval garrison served to keep it from complete desertion. Later, in the evil days of strife, even before the time of Harry Seldon, the weaker sort of men, tired of the periodic decades of insecurity and danger, weary of sacked planets and a ghostly succession of ephemeral emperors making their way to the purple for a few wicked, fruitless years, these men fled the populated centers and sought shelter in the barren nooks of the galaxy. Along the chilly wastes of Rossim, villages huddled. Its sun was a small, ruddy niggard that clutched its dribble of heat to itself while snow beat thinly down for 9 months of the year. The tough native grain lay dormant in the soil those snow-filled months, then grew and ripened in almost panic speed, when the sun's reluctant radiation brought the temperature to nearly 50. Small goat-like animals cropped the grasslands, kicking the thin snow aside with tiny, tri-hooved feet. The men of Rossum had, thus, their bread and their milk, and when they could spare an animal, even their meat. The darkly ominous forests that gnarled their way over half of the equatorial region of the planet supplied a tough, fine-grained wood for housing. This wood, together with certain furs and minerals, was even worth exporting, and the ships of the Empire came at times and brought in exchange farm machinery, atomic heaters, even televisor sets. The last was not really incongruous, for the long winter imposed a lonely hibernation upon the peasant. Imperial history flowed past the peasants of Rossum. The trading ships might bring news in impatient spurts. Occasionally, new fugitives would arrive. At one time, a relatively large group arrived in a body and remained, and these usually had the news of the galaxy. It was then that the Rossumites learned of sweeping battles and decimated populations, or of tyrannical emperors and rebellious viceroys, and they would sigh and shake their heads and draw their fur collars closer about their bearded faces as they sat about the village square in the weak sun and philosophized on the evil of men. Then, after a while, no trading ships arrived at all, and life grew harder. Supplies of foreign soft food, of tobacco, of machinery stopped. Vague word from scraps gathered on the televisor brought increasingly disturbing news. And finally it spread that Trantor had been sacked. The great capital world of all the galaxy, the splendid, storied, unapproachable, and incomparable home of the emperors, had been despoiled and ruined and brought to utter destruction. It was something inconceivable, and to many of the peasants of Rossum, scratching away at their fields, it might well seem that the end of the galaxy was at hand. And then one day, not unlike other days, a ship arrived again. The old men of each village nodded wisely, and lifted their old eyelids to whisper that thus it had been in their father's time. But it wasn't, quite. This ship was not an imperial ship. The glowing spaceship and sun of the Empire was missing from its prow. It was a stubby affair made of scraps of older ships, and the men within called themselves Soldiers of Tezenda. The peasants were confused. They had not heard of Tezenda, but they greeted the soldiers nevertheless in the traditional fashion of hospitality. The newcomers inquired closely as to the nature of the planet, the number of its inhabitants, the number of its cities, a word mistaken by the peasants to mean villages, to the confusion of all concerned, its type of economy, and so on. Other ships came, and proclamations were issued all over the world that Tezenda was now the ruling world, that tax-collecting stations would be established girdling the equator, the inhabited region, that percentages of grain and furs, according to certain numerical formulae, would be collected annually. The Rossumites had blinked solemnly, uncertain of the word taxes. When collection time came, many had paid, or had stood by in confusion, while the uniformed other worldlings loaded the harvested corn and the pelts onto the broad ground cars. Here and there indignant peasants banded together and brought out ancient hunting weapons, but of this nothing ever came. Grumblingly they had disbanded when the men of Tezenda came, and with dismay watched their hard struggle for existence become harder. But a new equilibrium was reached. The Tezendian governor lived dourly in the village of Gentry, from which all Rossumites were barred. He and the officials under him were dim otherworld beings that rarely impinged on the Rossumite ken. The tax farmers, Rossumites in the employ of Tezenda, came periodically, but they were creatures of custom now. And the peasant had learned how to hide his grain and drive his cattle into the forest and refrain from having his hut appear too ostentatiously prosperous. Then, with a dull, uncomprehending expression, he would greet all sharp questioning as to his assets by merely pointing at what they could see. Even that grew less, and taxes decreased, almost as if Tezenda wearied of extorting pennies from such a world. Trading sprang up, and perhaps Tezenda found that more profitable. The men of Rossum no longer received in exchange the polished creations of the Empire, but even Tezendian machines and Tezendian food was better than the native stuff. And there were clothes for the women of other than gray homespun, which was a very important thing. So once again, galactic history glided past peacefully enough, and the peasants scrabbled life out of the hard soil. Nairobi blew into his beard as he stepped out of his cottage. The first snows were sifting across the hard ground, and the sky was a dull, overcast pink. He squinted carefully upward and decided that no real storm was in sight. He could travel to Gentry without too much trouble and get rid of his surplus grain in return for enough canned foods to last the winter. He roared back through the door, which he opened a crack for the purpose.
"Has the car been fed its fuel, Yunker?"
A voice shouted from within, and then Narovi's oldest son, his short red beard not yet completely outgrown its boyish sparseness, joined him. "The car," he said sullenly, "is fueled and rides well, but for the bad condition of the axles. For that I am of no blame. I have told you it needs expert repairs." The old man stepped back and surveyed his son through lowering eyebrows, then thrust his hairy chin outward.
"And is the fault mine? Where and in what manner may I achieve expert repairs? Has the harvest then been anything but scanty for 5 years? Have my herds escaped the pest? Have the pelts climbed of themselves? Narovi!"
The well-known voice from within stopped him in mid-word. He grumbled,
"Well, well, and now your mother must insert herself into the affairs of a father and his son. Bring out the car, and see to it that the storage trailers are securely attached."
He pounded his gloved hands together and looked upward again. The dimly ruddy clouds were gathering, and the gray sky that showed in the rifts bore no warmth. The sun was hidden. He was at the point of looking away when his drooping eyes caught, and his finger almost automatically rose on high while his mouth fell open in a shout, in complete disregard of the cold air.
"Wife!" he called vigorously. "Old woman, come here!"
An indignant head appeared at the window. The woman's eyes followed his finger, gaped. With a cry, she dashed down the wooden stairs, snatching up an old wrap and a square of linen as she went. She emerged with the linen wrapped insecurely over her head and ears, and the wrap dangling from her shoulders. She snuffled.
"It is a ship from outer space."
And Narovi remarked impatiently,
"And what else could it be? We have visitors, old woman. Visitors!"
The ship was sinking slowly to a landing on the bare, frozen field in the northern portions of Narovi's farm.
"But what shall we do?" gasped the woman. "Can we offer these people hospitality? Is the dirt floor of our hovel to be theirs, and the pickings of last week's hoe cake? Shall they then go to our neighbors?"
Narovi purpled past the crimson induced by the cold, and his arms in their sleek fur covering lunged out and seized the woman's brawny shoulders.
"Wife of my soul," he purred, "you will take the 2 chairs from our room downstairs. You will see that a fat youngling is slaughtered and roasted with tubers. You will bake a fresh hoe cake. I go now to greet these men of power from outer space. And...
He paused, placed his great cap awry, and scratched hesitantly.
"Yes, I shall bring my jug of brewed grain as well. Hearty drink is pleasant."
The woman's mouth had flapped idly during this speech. Nothing came out. And when that stage passed, it was only a discordant screech that issued. Narovi lifted a finger.
"Old woman, what was it the village elders said a sennight since? Huh? Stir your memory. The elders went from farm to farm, themselves. Imagine the importance of it. To ask us that should any ships from outer space land, they were to be informed immediately on the orders of the governor. And now shall I not seize the opportunity to win into the good graces of those in power? Regard that ship. Have you ever seen its like? These men from outer worlds are rich, great. The governor himself sends such urgent messages concerning them that the elders walk from farm to farm in the cooling weather. Perhaps the message is sent throughout all Rossim that these men are greatly desired by the lords of Tazenda. And it is on my farm that they are landing."
He fairly hopped for anxiety.
"The proper hospitality now, the mention of my name to the governor, and what may not be ours?"
His wife was suddenly aware of the cold biting through her thin house clothing. She leaped towards the door, shouting over her shoulders,
"Leave then, quickly!"
But she was speaking to a man who was even then racing towards the segment of the horizon against which the ship sank. Neither the cold of the world, nor its bleak, empty spaces, worry General Han Pritcher, nor the poverty of the surroundings, nor the perspiring peasant himself. What did bother him was the question of the wisdom of their tactics. He and Shanice were alone here.
The ship, left in space, could take care of itself in ordinary circumstances, but still he felt unsafe. It was Channis, of course, who was responsible for this move. He looked across at the young man and caught him winking cheerfully at the gap in the furred partition, in which a woman's peeping eyes and gaping mouth momentarily appeared. Channis, at least, seemed completely at ease. That fact Pritchard savored with a vinegary satisfaction. His game had not much longer to proceed exactly as he wished it. Yet meanwhile, their wrist ultra-wave sender receivers were their only connection with the ship. And then the peasant host smiled enormously and bobbed his head several times and said in a voice oily with respect, "Noble lords, I crave leave to tell you that my eldest son, a good, worthy lad, whom my poverty prevents from educating as his wisdom deserves, has informed me that the elders will arrive soon. I trust your stay here has been as pleasant as my humble means, for I am poverty-stricken, though a hard-working, honest, and humble farmer, as anyone here will tell you, could afford." "Elders," said Channis lightly, "the chief men of the region here?" "So they are, noble lords, and honest, worthy men, all of them, for our entire village is known throughout Rossum as a just and righteous spot, though living is hard and the returns of the fields and forests meager. Perhaps you will mention to the elders, noble lords, of my respect and honor for travelers, and it may happen that they will request a new motor wagon for our household, as the old one can scarcely creep, and upon the remnant of it depends our livelihood." He looked humbly eager, and Han Pritcher nodded with the properly aloof condescension required of the role of noble lords bestowed upon them. "A report of your hospitality shall reach the ears of your elders." Pritcher seized the next moments of isolation to speak to the apparently half-sleeping Channis. "I am not particularly fond of this meeting of the elders," he said. "Have you any thoughts on the subject?" Channis seemed surprised. "No. What worries you?" "It seems we have better things to do than to become conspicuous here." Channis spoke hastily, in a low, monotoned voice. "It may be necessary to risk becoming conspicuous in our next moves. We won't find the type of men we want, Pritcher, by simply reaching out a hand into a dark bag and groping. Men who rule by tricks of the mind need not necessarily be men in obvious power. In the first place, the psychologists of the Second Foundation are probably a very small minority of the total population, just as on your own First Foundation, the technicians and scientists formed a minority. The ordinary inhabitants are probably just that, very ordinary. The psychologists may even be well hidden, and the men in the apparently ruling position may honestly think they are the true masters. Our solution to that problem may be found here on this frozen lump of a planet." "I don't follow that at all. Why, see here, it's obvious enough. Tazenda is probably a huge world of millions or hundreds of millions. How could we identify the psychologists among them and be able to report truly to the mule that we have located the Second Foundation? But here, on this tiny peasant world and subject planet, all the Tazendian rulers, our host informs us, are concentrated in their chief village of gentry. There may be only a few hundred of them there, Pritcher, and among them must be one or more of the men of the Second Foundation. We will go there eventually, but let us see the elders first. It's a logical step on the way." They drew apart easily as their black-bearded host tumbled into the room again, obviously agitated. "Noble lords, the elders are arriving. I crave leave to beg you once more to mention a word, perhaps, on my behalf." He almost bent double in a paroxysm of fawning. "We shall certainly remember you," said Channis. "Are these your elders?" They apparently were. There were three. One approached. He bowed with a dignified respect and said, "We are honored. Transportation has been provided, respected sirs, and we hope for the pleasure of your company at our meeting hall." Third interlude. The first speaker gazed wistfully at the night sky. Wispy clouds scudded across the faint star gleams. Space looked actively hostile. It was cold and awful at best, but now it contained that strange creature, the mule, and the very content seemed to darken and thicken it into ominous threat. The meeting was over. It had not been long. There had been the doubts and questionings inspired by the difficult mathematical problem of dealing with a mental mutant of uncertain makeup. All the extreme permutations had to be considered. Were they even yet certain? Somewhere in this region of space, within reaching distance as galactic spaces go, was the mule. What would he do? It was easy enough to handle his men. They reacted, and were reacting, according to plan. But what of the mule himself? Chapter 4. Two Men and the Elders. The elders of this particular region of Rossim were not exactly what one might have expected. They were not a mere extrapolation of the peasantry. Older, more authoritative, less friendly. Not at all. The dignity that had marked them at first meeting had grown in impression till it had reached the mark of being their predominant characteristic. They sat about their oval table like so many grave and slow-moving thinkers. Most were a trifle past their physical prime, though the few who possessed beards wore them short and neatly arranged. Still, enough appeared younger than 40 to make it quite obvious that elders was a term of respect rather than entirely a literal description of age. The two from outer space were at the head of the table, and in the solemn silence that accompanied a rather frugal meal that seemed ceremonious rather than nourishing, absorbed the new, contrasting atmosphere. After the meal, and one or two respectful remarks, too short and simple to be called speeches, had been made by those of the elders apparently held most in esteem, an informality forced itself upon the assembly. It was as if the dignity of greeting foreign personages had finally given way to the amiable, rustic qualities of curiosity and friendliness. They crowded around the two strangers, and a flood of questions came. They asked if it were difficult to handle a spaceship, how many men were required for the job, if better motors could be made for their ground cars, if it was true that it rarely snowed on other worlds, as was said to be the case with Tezenda, how many people lived on their world, if it was as large as Tezenda, if it was far away, how their clothes were woven, and what gave them the metallic shimmer, why they did not wear furs, if they shaved every day, what sort of stone was that in Pritchard's ring, the list stretched out. And almost always the questions were addressed to Pritchard, as though as the elder, they automatically invested him with the greater authority. Pritchard found himself forced to answer at greater and greater length. It was like an immersion in a crowd of children. Their questions were those of utter and disarming wonder. Their eagerness to know was completely irresistible and would not be denied. Pritchard explained that spaceships were not difficult to handle and that crews varied with the size, from one to many, that the motors of their ground cars were unknown in detail to him, but could doubtless be improved, that the climates of worlds varied almost infinitely, that many hundreds of millions lived on his world, but that it was far smaller and more insignificant than the great empire of Tezenda, that their clothes were woven of silicone plastics, in which metallic luster was artificially produced by proper orientation of the surface molecules, and that they could be artificially heated so that furs were unnecessary, that they shaved every day, that the stone in his ring was an amethyst. The list stretched out. He found himself thawing to these naive provincials against his will. And always, as he answered, there was a rapid chatter among the elders, as though they debated the information gained. It was difficult to follow these inner discussions of theirs, for they lapsed into their own accented version of the universal galactic language, that through long separation from the currents of living speech had become archaic. Almost, one might say, their curt comments among themselves hovered on the edge of understanding, but just managed to elude the clutching tendrils of comprehension. Until finally Channis interrupted to say, "Good sirs, you must answer us for a while, for we are strangers and would be very much interested to know all we can of Tezenda." And what happened then was that a great silence fell, and each of the hitherto voluble elders grew silent. Their hands, which had been moving in such rapid and delicate accompaniment to their words, as though to give them greater scope and varied shades of meaning, fell suddenly limp. They stared furtively at one another, apparently quite willing each to let the other have all the floor. Pritchard interposed quickly. "My companion asks this in friendliness, for the fame of Tezenda fills the galaxy, and we, of course, shall inform the governor of the loyalty and love of the elders of Rossem." No sigh of relief was heard, but faces brightened. An elder stroked his beard with thumb and forefinger, straightened its slight curl with a gentle pressure, and said, "We are faithful servants of the lords of Tezenda." Pritchard's annoyance at Chanis's bald question subsided. It was apparent, at least, that the age that he had felt creeping over him of late had not yet deprived him of his own capacity for making smooth the blunders of others. He continued, "We do not know, in our far part of the universe, much of the past history of the lords of Tazenda. We presume they have ruled benevolently here for a long time." The same elder who spoke before answered,